Wednesday Talk Radio. My name's Paul Rowland. Again, you can re-listen to this program in its entirety and all the other programs that I've done over the past few years at kboo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. And you can find links to that article that we were talking about, The Uninhabitable Earth, and all the other articles that have come out, a slew, dozens, I think, have come out in reaction to it. And some of the articles that David Wallace-Wells had deepening the whole issue by going more into depth in the interviews he had with the scientists that he talked to for that article. So thank you, Robert. We got to run.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Life, Art, Being, Integrative Arts Festival, taking place July 28th to August 5th at various locations around Portland. The Life, Art, Being, Integrative Arts Festival will include workshops, panel discussions, and performances about somatic, expressive, deep ecology, and community building, creative, and ecological practices. Again, that's the Life, Art, Being, Integrative Arts Festival taking place July 28th to August 5th at various locations around Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good morning. The time is 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have for you coming up for the remainder of the morning on KBOO. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, The Food Show talks to anti-hunger activist and author Andy Fisher about his book, Big Hunger, that looks at the hunger industrial complex. But coming right up, we've got Project Censored Radio, talking about the various meanings behind the word nationalist. And we, of course, thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one very easily when you go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Thanks in advance for taking care of that. And now we go to Project Censored Radio.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon. On today's program, we will discuss Islam and journalism in America. We'll be joined by our guest, Manar Mahawish of Mint Press News. Please stay with us. But change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of just our brothers and our sisters. We're a people together can overthrow the system. We won. Brothers and our sisters, the people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of the brothers and our sisters.
minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. Later on, we'll be joined by our special correspondent, Amy Casey. And it's nice. We got the whole crew back together again in Hayward. We are broadcasting live from CSU East Bay and looking for a show about Islam journalism, which is becoming more and more relevant given Trump's Muslim ban as well as this war on journalism. You excited to talk about these things, Desiree?
Totally.
I could tell. People missed you. They're happy you're back.
Yay, that's great.
All right, so Amy, why don't you tell us who's on the show today?
All right, thank you, Nolan. Greetings, listeners. I am Amy Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation. Today's guest, Manar Mahawish of Mint Press News. Manar Mahawish is founder, CEO, and editor-in-chief of Mint Press News, a watchdog journalism organization exposing the link between special interest groups and big money with policies at home and war abroad. Mahawish is also a regular speaker on responsible journalism, sexism, neoconservatism within the media and journalism startups. She is also former TV host and producer of Behind the Headline on Free Speech TV that aired in 2016. She started her career as an independent multimedia journalist covering Midwest and national politics while focusing on civil liberties and social justice issues, posting her reporting and exclusive interviews on her blog, Mint Press, which she later turned into Mint Press into the global news source it is today. In 2009, Mahawish also became the first American woman to wear the hijab to anchor and report the news in American media. Mahawish is also a wife and mother of a 7-year-old boy, juggling her duties as a CEO and motherly tasks successfully as supermom.
All right, Manar, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. If you wouldn't mind, could you give our listeners a little background on Mint Press News, like how long it's been around, where they can access it, and those sorts of things?
Absolutely. Well, our website is mintpressnews.com, and we launched in 2012, so we're just a few years old here. And we're part of the new media, independent media, I would say, revival or revolution, as we'd like to call it. And part of our purpose is to combat, the real fake news that the mainstream and corporate media spew every single day. It's the junk food news, junk food headlines that we're inundated day in and day out. Part of our mission is to expose the driving factors of war, imperialism abroad, and then also what are the driving factors and the special interest groups that influence politics at home as well, that are, quashing our civil liberties and affecting our democracy. And so we are on Facebook, we are on YouTube, and we are on Twitter. And, since we've launched, we've been able to reach pretty steadily about 2 million unique visitors per month. And most of that has been through organic growth. And I think it's mostly because our success is, we can point a lot of our success and organic growth to the fact that most Americans, over 70% now, I think the most recent Gallup poll, I think it's even higher than that, don't trust the corporate media anymore. So people are very, very thirsty for real, honest reporting on the issues that the corporate media doesn't talk about. I know there's a huge backlash right now from the corporate media. Anything that challenges them, they label it as fake news. Well, they are the real fake news. And so we're trying to bring back and restore the fourth estate.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to get into that term with you. There's kind of been this weird bedfellows that have been created in the Trump era, because on the one hand, Trump is attacking a lot of these corporate news agencies, calling them fake news, which I would say is correct. But he's calling them fake news because they criticize him, which I see as part of like this larger war on journalism, which is any journalist who criticizes Trump is somehow fake news, whether corporate or independent. So I'm wondering, you know, how do you see that being this independent journalist, given the contemporary context of the relationship between politicians and the media?
You know, it's an interesting time in Trump land, because I would say that we agree with Trump that, you know, the corporate media is fake news. But we have to be really careful. And it's interesting because there is this trend where anything that Trump says, you know, people on the left are going to call him a psychopath or narcissistic or whatever. And so they've kind of jumped on this bandwagon of kind of attacking his attack on the media. But we have to be a little fair here and say that, you know, yeah, his criticism does come from the fact that the media is criticizing him. But that is the one area that I think that we can all agree that the corporate media is fake news. But what's really upsetting is that you're seeing people on the left, you know, all of a sudden they're citing the corporate media. They're leaning towards this, you know, the Hillary Clinton, CNN media, and other organizations like the New York Times and the Associated Press to criticize Trump. So all of a sudden you have like this new leftist movement who's like joining the corporate media in criticizing Trump and pushing kind of this Russia phobia and, like, you know, the bromance between Putin and Trump. I hope that makes sense. But we have to give Trump just a tiny bit of credit for making this one assertion that the corporate media is fake news. And so I think that as an independent journalist, I think that that's the one area that we can agree with Trump on.
Yeah, I think it makes absolute sense. Me and Nick are very familiar with bromances, so that's true.
Manara, this is Desiree. First, I just wanted to agree with what you just said, but then I also wanted to get your perspective on how people may view or how you view Trump's relationship with the media, specifically CNN, and who he's calling fake news now. At the beginning of election, when he was getting all the spotlight, he was on every network, like, nonstop, and almost getting, like, this huge free publicity stunt. And then fast forward to now, he's attacking the media and him are in a battle, and it's almost like, do you see this as, like, it was set up this way? Do you think that it was kind of just a consequence of people turning on the media, and so Trump wanted to kind of distance himself from people saying that the media interfered with the election? How do you view that?
Well, I think it's all theatrical, you know, just like the elections were just one big, you know, circus. I think this whole media frenzy over Trump is one media, you know, one big media circus as well. If the corporate media wanted to truly and truly, truly, truly criticize Trump, they would go after the deep state. They would go after his neocolonial foreign policy. They would go after, you know, the rise of the, you know, the far right and so forth. But they're not. They're going after, like, his daughter, Ivanka. He's going after, like, his relationships. And they're going after his, you know, relationship or, you know, his supposed alleged bromance with Putin. But there's, like, no mention within the corporate media. And here, this is my criticism of, you know, CNN is, you know, obviously they're not going after his policies in Syria or his policy for expanding the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq. They're not going after those policies that people should probably know about. So it's all theatrics, in my opinion, and from what I'm seeing. And when it comes to CNN, you know, the coverage that's coming out of CNN, obviously CNN is a major perpetrator of fake news. And we now have, you know, leaked video that had come out, I think it was last week, of a CNN producer saying that this whole Russia phobia and, like, this bromance between Trump and Putin is, like, you know, just good for ratings. It's fake. There's no evidence of any election hacking by the Russians and so forth. And so they're pushing out these narratives to demonize and push this, you know, Russia phobic narrative that supports, of course, the Democratic Party and their foreign policies and the neocons. But, you know, we really have to be kind of critical of both. And although I do agree with that one aspect of Trump calling the corporate media fake news, I mean, both of them are wrong from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. So when it occurs to me, too, that well, we have this fake news coming out of CNN. On the one hand, yeah, it is used to support the Democratic Party. But I think it's also part of, like, a larger process of hurting journalists, right? Because this continues to just give people a reason to lack faith in journalism. And I'm wondering how you see mm-hmm. that affect the type of work you do, where, you know, increasingly people, a lot of people don't see the difference between corporate and independent journalists. And so, you know, they see journalism having these problems and they think all journalists are the problem. And Trump certainly has echoed that narrative with his recent tweets and et cetera. So I'm wondering, how do you see that as affecting you and the work you do?
Well, I meet everyday average people. I mean, you know, the trust in journalism in general has gone down so much. I mean, what you're saying is absolutely correct. People just don't trust the media, and it is because of, not because of the work we're doing, you know, we're reaching a very specific demographic and audience, people who are really, you know, smarter and wiser. You know, they've made the decision already that the corporate media is fake news, and they're looking for an alternative. But the average American doesn't, you know, they don't have the, you know, the, how do I say this? Like, they don't have the, maybe the, as much critical thinking skills to kind of jump out of that, you know, paradox of, you know, corporate media. So they kind of, you know, blend all of journalism and all of journalists together because of what they see from CNN. And so this has obviously hurt independent journalists because, like, you know, we're trying to send a message that challenges the mainstream, that challenges the corporate media, but the damage seems to be already done, that journalism cannot, you know, journalists cannot be trusted. They all have some sort of agenda, as, you know, as Trump would put it, or the way CNN has made themselves out to appear. So they've really ruined it for everybody. But I think it's also a really important time to hang on to that and to grab on to those people who are really frustrated with the media. You know, they may be really skeptical and critical, and maybe they don't trust the media. Maybe they don't even want to, you know, even read the corporate media. Maybe they don't even want to get involved, because I hear this a lot when I give presentations. They're like, you know, I don't even trust the media. It's too depressing. You know, everybody has their own agenda. Everyone's so opinionated. I don't even know how to differentiate fact from fiction anymore. I mean, I hear this. I'm sure you guys hear this all the time, too. And so I think, you know, even though it's tough to get those people on board, it's also an opportunity for us to kind of reach out to them and sit down with them and talk to them about these kind of differences so that they can be able to see and differentiate between fake news and real news.
Well, I'm glad you brought that point up as well. It's something that I've struggled with too, is how to reach out to other groups in this age of like divisive politics and demonizing other people. How do you sort of tap into that human element that exists in every person to try and reach out to say, like, maybe you can check out something at Mint Press, you know, look at it and see what it says, evaluate it, and potentially this may change your views. I mean, how have you felt, like, how successful have you been at doing that?
You know, one thing that, you know, I'll share my personal experience, you know, as a Muslim, as a hijab, as a woman, as a young woman, journalists and female journalists in the U.S. with the rise of, you know, all this Islamophobia, I've had to put myself in really uncomfortable positions, sometimes in areas in the state of Minnesota where I'm from, for example, like in Michelle Bachmann districts, in neo-Nazi district areas, and give presentations to people that would normally would never listen to me. But I've, you know, inserted myself into those situations and kind of presented, because I do a lot of presentations at universities and local events, and I've presented the news and politics in a way that kind of overlooks party lines, and I think that's really, really important, and kind of sends a message of unity and peace, and that there is a bigger, deeper state that's trying to divide us. And that always seems to work. I mean, I don't think I've ever failed in sending that message of peace and unity from that perspective. You know, it really takes away, you know, people get really uncomfortable at the very beginning when they start hearing these things, but it really kind of takes away all those uncomfortable feelings, and they start to open up their heart and realize that, you know, we're actually a lot more similar. So from my experience, even though, you know, my journalism has nothing to do with my religion, you know, I do wear hijab, and so when people see me, they have those kind of ideas because of the rise of Islamophobia. And so before I can even talk to them about war, before I can even talk to them about all these issues, I have to kind of break those barriers and those shackles. And I've been really successful in doing that in my state. and in presentations I've given across the country. And it's uncomfortable. It's hard, but it is doable. And again, that's just from my perspective and my experience.
Manar, can you share your experience being a Muslim woman, like you said, being a Muslim and a woman in the time of the 9/11 era all the way up till now? Do you see this as like the rise in kind of like the 9/11 2.0, where we have the super drived hate against Islam and Islamophobia, but then with Trump kind of heading this movement, he's also taken a special jab at women specifically. So what's your experience with that then and now?
Well, it's always been very tough being a woman in general, so that definitely has not changed. But I definitely agree with you in the way you described it as like a post 9/11 2.0 kind of era. I feel like, and maybe it's because I was a lot younger at the time, but I feel like after 9/11, it was easier to be Muslim. You know, it was tough at the time. I mean, I had received discrimination. You know, people in my classroom would tell me that I was related to Osama bin Laden. You know, I was pretty young. I was like in the junior high going into high school when 9/11 happened. And so definitely faced that discrimination. But I also had this hope, you know, inside of me that, you know, I'm going to change perspectives and I'm going to break barriers. That's part of the reason why I became a journalist, is because of, you know, just like every other person in this country, I was inundated with the fear-mongering, with the Islamophobia, with the same messages and, you know, extreme propaganda that all Muslims are bad and Islam is a jihadist religion that's out to kill and destroy the world. I mean, all of these things are absolutely ridiculous, and it's obviously driven by fear, and it's used to justify, of course, our ever-growing war machine across the Middle East and Africa and predominantly Muslim nations. And so I made the connection at a very young age that there was a deeper meaning behind this propaganda. And so that's why I chose to become a journalist and wanted to expose the military-industrial complex for what it was. I wanted to expose that Islamophobia industry. And from there, I went on to work in independent journalism and, you know, do my own work and so forth. And I actually didn't wear hijab at the time, but later on, I decided to wear hijab. And then I soon actually became the first American, you know, woman to wear the hijab to anchor and report the news in American media. And so that was a very, very big deal. And at the time, many Muslims wouldn't go into journalism. I would go and speak, and I was like, you know, we need to rise up and like represent ourselves in a better way, especially the woman, because there was this idea based from this propaganda that women, especially Muslim women, were oppressed. They couldn't think for themselves. They weren't powerful. They weren't independent. They weren't intelligent. And so this was obviously goes against, you know, reality. And so I would try to kind of gather Muslim women, like, we have to rise up and, you know, become part of the political atmosphere, become, you know, part of the media industry so that we can change perspectives. But they were so scared because they were let down by the media. And I just didn't allow that to happen. Failure was not an option in my perspective and in my heart. And so at that time, I had that hope and that, you know, the fact that I saw so many people let down by the media, that actually gave me more strength to carry on and continue. And things were getting really better for a while. But the Islamophobia industry has only grown. I believe it's worth over $3 million per year. We have special interest groups that, like, directly profit from war, who want to link, you know, Muslims to the war on terror and jihadis and ISIS and all of these things, when most of these terrorists are being funded by our own deep state and our intelligence community. And so, you know, we just, you know, it's just been a struggle to be able to expose those things, but it's also given, you know, rise and a bigger platform for people like myself to speak up and to, you know, bring that unity back to where it needs to be. And that was kind of my long answer. I apologize for going off the top, but it has definitely been an interesting journey to get to the point where we are today.
We are talking to Mint Press CEO and supermom, Manar Mahawish, and we're going to take a short musical break and when we come back, we're going to talk about what is Mint Press News covering now and what does Manar think about Trump's Muslim ban, as it's called. So we'll be back after this short musical break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. We are talking to Manar Mahawish of Mint Press News. I am in studio with Amy Casey, Desiree McSwain, and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. Manar, before we took a break, I said I want to talk a little bit about what are the type of stories or what stories is Mint Press covering right now that our listeners can check out on your website?
Well, this week we've been kind of covering some of the issues taking place with this Russia phobia bromance connection between Trump and Putin. As you know, Putin and Trump are meeting today. I believe they actually met in the last hour or so. And so one of the major stories that we're covering is the fact that CNN and the New York Times and the Associated Press have retracted the claim that 17 U.S. intelligence agencies agree that Russia hacks U.S. elections. And then on top of that, in the past week, we've seen CNN producers, you know, under leaked video, admit that the whole Russia connection with the elections is like a big hoax. It's basically fake news, and they just have been pushing that narrative for ratings. And so that's one major story that we've been covering for the last week and a half to 2 weeks. Another story that we're covering is India being pulled out of BRICS. I mean, India is still part of the BRICS coalition, but Israel and the United States are kind of trying to charm India into pulling out of BRICS through arms, massive, massive arms sales. And so those are two of the big stories that we're covering this week, and they're both on our website.
Yeah, I know this from working at Project Censored for years. You eventually get a reputation as a place that people can trust, people who want information out that they can't get out elsewhere. And I'm wondering, Mint Press has been around now for just about 5 years. Have you experienced that? Do you have folks coming to you with story ideas? Are you starting to get a reputation? I mean, I know you have one with us, but are you getting a reputation with other groups as well as somewhere people can go to get information out that is not reported elsewhere?
Absolutely. I mentioned this at the very beginning. Part of our growth has been just tremendous, you know, growth through organic readership. You know, for not having any sort of marketing budget, you know, because we're such a small organization, you know, we've been able to reach about 2 million readers per month, unique visitors per month, pretty steadily over the course of the last 2.5 years since we've, you know, grown and so forth. And so our growth has been tremendous from that perspective. And we have contributors, analysts, and journalists, and investigative journalists who work for a multitude of organizations that reach out to us constantly, who are pitching stories, and we've built a lot of great partnerships, and one is actually with Project Censored and other news organizations. And so, you know, part of that too is not because we've had an easy time growing, it's because we've had a challenging time growing. And I think that's where a lot of news organizations kind of get it wrong, is, you know, you have to take a stance and challenge certain stories and be okay with the backlash. And so that's kind of what we've done, is we've been okay challenging war narratives. We've been okay challenging, you know, certain coverage issues that even some alternative media organizations won't even touch, like Syria or Libya, or what's happening with those conflicts. And so, you know, that's also been attributed to a lot of our growth and building kind of the respect within the community, is that we're going to get a lot of backlash, but that's okay because we know we're doing the right thing. And I think that's all that matters at the end of the day.
Well, I kind of want to talk about both the backlash you're receiving as well as the suffering and fear you're seeing in light of the Supreme Court's decision to allow Trump's so-called Muslim ban to continue. And so I'm kind of wondering, yeah, what backlash have you felt from that? What sort of suffering and fear have you seen in your general area?
Well, I mean, we have to dig a little bit deeper into this, you know, so-called Muslim ban. I mean, the countries that these people are being banned from are the very countries we're actively destroying, you know, like Syria, like Iran. You know, we have like a covert regime change operation taking place in Iran. It's never ended. It's still ongoing. Countries like Afghanistan and so forth. And so these are countries that we're actively destroying. We're actively arming right-wing rebels. We're, you know, covertly trying to change the regimes in those countries. And so it's one thing to say that it's a Muslim ban, but I think people need to get really honest and see what this ban is really against. It's against the very refugees who are fleeing our wars. They're fleeing our foreign policy. I think I read this morning that the amount of refugees that have died escaping war just in the last couple of weeks was over 2,000 people. And, you know, I know that, you know, us consumers of news, especially if we're working directly in the news, 2,000 might not seem like that big of a number, but that's like 2,000 human beings, most of which who are children, actually. A lot of these families are escaping with five kids at a time and so forth. They're drowning in the seas. And so, we really have to be able to humanize these people that are being banned, from trying to find safety. And so that's, I think, the problem with a lot of this is they're not being humanized. It's just being called a Muslim ban, which it is. You know, for the most part, it is. It's not everybody who's Muslim that's fleeing, but for the most part, it is targeting these Muslims. But where the media has really failed us and where people are kind of getting it wrong is that they're banning people who are the most vulnerable in the world, who have nothing left. And so I think that's where, that connection there with the lack of humanization all goes back to that kind of Islamophobia industry and kind of the backlash that, you know, myself has received and other, you know, Muslim Americans have received. It's like that lack of empathy for the fact that we're all just human beings trying to survive in this world full of war.
Manar, this is Nick Baham. I wanted to ask you sort of on in terms of ideological constructions of what is a good Muslim and what is a bad Muslim, and how the Muslim ban sets up these ideological constructions. So how do you see that? You know, what as we're moving forward with this, what is, in your view, a good Muslim and what is a bad Muslim? And I'm speaking specifically in terms of how this travel ban sets up those ideological constructions. Is a good Muslim simply someone who allows a Trump hotel in their country, and a bad Muslim someone who does not? How do you see this shaping out?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because I've heard that argument made. Well, what if the bad guys get through? What do we do about that? And I think that we're asking the wrong question when it comes to, the ban. I think before we even look at banning people and, dehumanizing these victims of wars, we have to look at what brought this situation to the forefront. I mean, we're seeing one of the largest refugee crises since World War II at the hands and at the cost of, you know, this war and war of aggression and this very aggressive and hawkish foreign policy. And so when we think of the bad Muslim, you know, the idea of the bad Muslim, we think of people like ISIS or people like these right-wing rebel groups that are directly a creation of Western imperialism and modern-day colonialism to destabilize these countries, like in Syria, like in Libya, and like Iraq. And so before we even talk about the good and the bad Muslim, we have to really get down to business here and get to the root of the problem. I mean, it's so ironic that Trump is making this argument that, like, well, what if, you know, these bad guys come in, you know, groups like ISIS? And, you know, that's an interesting argument, and it's very possible. I'm not saying that it's not possible that somebody from these terror groups could join in. There's going to be bad guys everywhere, right? We have far right-wing people here that are extremely violent, that are within our borders, that we should be very afraid of. But at the same time, we need to, instead of attacking the very people, you know, trying to escape war, we need to kind of get to the root of the problem of why are there even these bad guys in the first place? Who's fueling them? Who's arming them? It's extremely ironic for countries, like Great Britain or Germany or whatever countries that are talking, that are, you know, spreading this fear even about these refugees, when they are the ones who are actively arming these right-wing groups that they are supposedly afraid of. And so we have to look at the irony here and call it out for what it is, which is, you know, it's a completely ironic
Manar, are we also losing any kind of discussion in our news media about secularism? And I'm speaking here to
about
secularism. And not only secularism in quote-unquote Islamic states like Oman or Senegal or Iran pre-CIA black ops, but also secularism in the United States. So what I'm speaking to is that there are, as we know, states that are predominantly Islamic or predominantly Christian, and yet there's a high degree of tolerance within those states. People don't wear their fundamentalist beliefs, if they have them, on their sleeves all the time. Are we losing any kind of nuanced discussions about secularism in both Christian and Islamic states?
I think the mainstream media and the corporate media and the establishment are. You know, my family is from the Middle East and they are mostly Muslim, but, you know, the majority of our neighbors were Jewish and they were Christian, they were other Muslims, but nobody pushed their religion on the other person. And that kind of idea of everybody living together is actually a fundamental belief of the Middle East. That's not what the media wants us to know. And they don't want us to believe that. I mean, if you look at the states that are actually being attacked right now by very aggressive foreign policies, those are the states where secularism and, you know, this idea of everybody living together, no matter what your religion is the root of those societies. I mean, if you look at Syria, if you look at Palestine, if you look at Libya, even Iraq, these are historically, these are countries that have had, you know, people from all religious backgrounds, from, you know, atheists to Christians to Muslims to Jews, where people lived together side by side and nobody pushed their religion on the other person. And so if we look at reality, that's how it actually is in the majority of these nations. But what's being pushed on the Middle East and a lot of these African nations, ironically, by the West, is a fundamentalist religious movement of Wahhabism and Salafism that is being funded by the West. And I think that's really where we need to, you know, again, get to kind of the root of the problem here, is why is there this fundamentalism, and why is this idea of unity and secularism where everybody can, like, live together side by side, why is that being destroyed? It's actually being destroyed by modern-day colonialism. And I think that's a really important and interesting topic to bring up. And it's one that's extremely dismissed by the media because they paint the Middle East as, like, this monolithic, you know, area in the world where everybody is, like, this fundamentalist, you know, Muslim, Wahhabi, women are oppressed. But in fact, those ideas actually were induced and put onto the Muslim world through British colonialism and, you know, now NATO colonialism.
Manar Mahawish of Mint Press News. Manar, remind our listeners, where can they get their Mint Press News from?
Well, they can get it from our website at mintpressnews.com. We're active on Facebook and on Twitter and on YouTube. So we're pretty active online. They can follow me as well on Twitter and Facebook at Manar Mahawish.
Manar, I could talk to you all day. I really appreciate you coming on the Project Censored show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
All right, we'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III, and we are joined by Amy Casey, who has a few reminders for our listeners.
Thank you, Nolan. Greetings again, listeners. This is Amy Casey with just a few reminders. We do want to hear from you. Please, please, please send us your feedback, any questions, comments, concerns. We want to hear it all. You can send your feedback to projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Now, in order to keep our show on the air, we need you to show your support and show us some love. For more information, please go to projectcensored.org/radio to learn how you can support the Project Censored show.
Cool. Thank you, Amy. I think we actually have some listener mail to discuss. Nick, you got some mail, didn't you?
Yes, I got a wonderful email from Bill from Redwood City. Bill writes, "Hey, Dr. Bayham, I heard you on Project Censored today. I'm a regular Pacifica, Democracy Now, etc. listener. One of the things I've been bugged about lately is the term white nationalist. This is partly because the term is used to describe those hillbillies who didn't get the message about who won the Civil War. They can't possibly be nationalists unless one is speaking of the Confederacy. Then there are the other racist wingnuts that have all sorts of weird ideas about the Constitution and the fringe on the flag and chemtrails. I wouldn't call them nationalists either because they don't seem to care about how their fellow U.S. citizens or the Constitution, especially equal protection, etc. I would urge you, in colloquy with your peers and others, to adopt more appropriate nomenclature. Right-wing militant, violent white racist, neo-Confederate, Christian blasphemer, anti-Christians, any of these would do as far as I'm concerned. Even when talking about nationalists in other countries, it's usually a group that wants to justify their hatred and bigotry by wrapping themselves in the flag. This, too, should not be dignified with the term nationalist. Yours truly." And I responded to Bill online and gave Bill's words quite a bit of thought, because we are using the term on the broadcast. And I think that Bill does a great job at helping us to think in a more sophisticated way about who is a white nationalist and who is not. I do want, Bill, if you're listening, I do want to give you a little bit of context here. I think we also need to be sophisticated in thinking about how actual white nationalists can manipulate the right-wing militant, the violent white racist, or the neo-Confederate. And I want to draw your attention to an article that I found very compelling that was written July the 6th in The Atlantic, entitled "The Racial and Religious Paranoia of Trump's Warsaw Speech," which happened on July the 5th. This article was written by Peter Beinart. And what he cites is the way that Trump used the term "the West" 10 times in his speech, and "our civilization" 5 times in his speech. He writes, "The West is a," and this is the Peter Beinart, "the West is a racial and religious term. To be considered Western, a country must be largely Christian, preferably Protestant or Catholic, and largely white. Where there is ambiguity about a country's Westernness, it's because there's ambiguity about or tensions between these two characteristics." And throughout the piece, Beinart talks about Bannon's white nationalist influence on that particular speech. And I do think I want us to remain sophisticated in how we understand this term, but also in how people who may not be properly speaking white nationalists can be manipulated by a white nationalist agenda.
Yeah, I think I read through this email and I thought about the way to use this term, like nationalist, and it brings up some points too. What I've always found kind of odd about the term is that a lot of these people are identified as white nationalists, usually want to tear down many of the foundations of the nation itself. Like, I consider the rise of Trump this anti-Enlightenment period, which the nation's founded on these Enlightenment ideals. Same thing with just like New Deal policies that were a major part of our history. They want to rip those apart too. So it is kind of odd to call them nationalists in that mm-hmm. they seem to seek to rip down the very foundations of the nation itself.
Yes, and in that regard, I think Bill really brings up an important point for us to think about on the program.
Mm-hmm. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but my kind of understanding or perception of white nationalists, at least in as far as their ideology and what they push it to be, is kind of the idea or the conception of creating a white nation or sustaining a white nation and white-only nation. So in that sense, it makes sense to me to say white nationalist. But then again, you know, it's also easy to kind of lump a lot of groups together. And like you said, a lot of people who may be just influenced by the agenda or by the ideology. So it definitely is good to have some discernment between the groups. But again, if essentially what they're talking about is a white nation that they want to sustain or build, white nationalist is kind of fitting. But correct me if I'm wrong.
I think it's certainly fitting, like when you hear Trump's speech in Poland, talking about Western, talking about Christian, not talking about universal values whatsoever. So, for example, is the right of self-determination a purely Western value, or do other people have it? And Trump has been setting, through Steve Bannon, has been setting the stage for this Samuel Huntington clash of civilizations, this war between the West and the rest, or the construction of the East. And those are definitively white nationalist expressions. The idea of setting up a Judeo-Christian white majority state. Are they, can they manipulate? The question I think Bill raises here is, can they manipulate just your sort of regular run-of-the-mill, I mean, I don't like the term, but Bill uses it, hillbilly. And I think the answer to that is, historically, the answer to that is yes. Those people can be manipulated into that agenda, even if they don't understand that agenda in its complexity.
Yeah, I've recently been reading Hochschild's book, Strangers in Their Own Land. And in the book, she talks about how she interviews white folks in the South, and she talks about how they have seen this, what they see as an attack by liberals, calling them racist and talking about white privilege and these things. And they don't understand where these concepts are coming from, right? Even though they're partaking in these behaviors, et cetera. And so they really lean toward like a Trump's America narrative, because Trump gives them sort of a safe place, a simple explanation. Well, liberals may have a theoretical point or evidence-based point. It's over the heads because it's not explained to these individuals. And so like you were talking about with white nationalism, Desiree, I was thinking that they take part in many of the same policies that further this white nation, sustaining this white nation, but don't realize they're doing it for that purpose. And so I think by calling them white nationalists, I think that's how you alienate potential allies. And kind of what we're talking about with Manar, like how do you tap into that human element to sit down and kind of explain to someone what they're doing rather than label them and make them scared or feel attacked?
Mm-hmm. I have an interesting kind of juxtapose to that too, because I've been called a black nationalist. And so it's interesting to think about two ideals and I guess what the body or the people kind of believe it to be, because they're the driving force. So from a lot of understanding from a lot of past teachers in the African or African-American community, like Khalid Muhammad and other people who believe in wanting to create and sustain a black nation anywhere in the world, because blacks are so isolated and so impoverished everywhere and lack any infrastructure or superstructure. So the ideal to create that and to be able to sustain that somewhere, even if we can't do it in our own homeland because we're attacked in Africa and all this kind of stuff. So that's kind of one ideal. But again, just hearing it or being labeled black nationalist, it kind of diverts from the real ideal of it. It's not like, you know, you want to kill other races and you want to wipe the world out of all, you know, anybody but black people. But I can't really necessarily say that that's not what white nationalists believe. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to kind of present this ideal and present like, wow, I think it would be beautiful to see a black community thriving somewhere solely by themselves, for themselves, and being called a black nationalist or being, you know, labeled with that same kind of ideology. But again, that could just be me only going off of what I've heard of white nationalists and what they believe. So,
yeah, Desiree, I think that, you know, certainly the roots of black nationalism and the ideals of people like Edward Blyden and then moving up the line through Marcus Garvey, even Elijah Muhammad, et cetera, are about the right to self-determination. It's a response to white nationalism. And this recognition that if you're going to have any power in the world, you got to have your own land. You got to have access to your resources. You got to be able to build an economy. I could make an argument to you that, which I think you'd probably agree with, because I've also been called a black nationalist quite a bit too, and that just because I teach it as a historical fact, that black success has to be linked in this country to ownership of land and resources. Mm-hmm. And that's whether we get it here or whether we get it in a wholly segregated community to be able to build up businesses and banks. And if you think about the absence of black banks in this country, or the very few, the dearth of black banks, how do you build a sense of wealth without, you know, credit in lending in this country? You have to have some capital to be able to do this. And that is central to black nationalism.
Yeah, I think that gets at the heart of the question I was bringing up earlier, though, as well, is taking the time or being able to have the communication with a lot of these white folks who engage in these white nationalist policies, but maybe not even know why they do it. You know, how would you explain something about like black nationalism and property ownership to, say, white working class folks who are living in poverty in like Louisiana? You know, how do you, that's like a question, like how do you draw that communication?
Yes.
And it seems that the approach that's done by, I would say, the Democratic Party has been this pity party and use these terms over these individuals' heads, which only sort of incites this anger rather than give a logical explanation for our history and why things are the way they are.
Well, the irony is here that the white nationalist who maybe is living in an impoverished community somewhere in southern Indiana, just to pick a place, will not get what they want through white nationalism. They're not going to get a piece of the economy.
That's a really good point.
They're not going to get ownership. So you can buy into the Trump Bannon nationalism. You're not going to get a taste. It's only going to be that top 1%. What you get is racial animus. So that hopefully that keeps you warm at night. Okay, you hate black folk, or you hate Muslims, or you hate women, or you hate gays. Maybe that keeps you warm at night because, you know, Trump has taken away your heating oil assistance for poor people, all right? So you're not even getting that. You're not getting land by removing people from this country through a Muslim ban. What does that mean if you're a white nationalist? Does that mean that you get to move into a property that was previously held by a Syrian refugee somewhere? No, that's not happening. You're getting nothing for it.
That's a good point. So what do we decide here on the terms? There's so many. I hear hillbilly. I like hillbilly. What else are you thinking here?
Well, I think that what Bill compels us to do is to think through this, as I think we've just done in this discussion, with greater sophistication. And I hear what you're saying, Nolan, about labeling. I think the only way that we're going to be able to effectively communicate through the news media to these types of individuals, which, by the way, has been done. Fred Hampton, a black nationalist, communicated to so-called white nationalists, right?
I mean, Marcus Garvey sat down with the KKK Grand Wizard, I think it was.
So. As did Elijah Muhammad.
Right.
So. Invited them to it. That, I think, is the most dangerous moment that can happen in this country, where you get disaffected people of color with disaffected whites. And then we all sit down and we realize, hey, here's the con, right? Mm. This race thing is the con, okay? Because we're not getting any land or anything from this game. But I think we have agreed to deal, Bill, if you're listening, we have agreed to deal with this with much greater sophistication because of you. So we want to thank you. And we want to thank you for being a dear listener.
Really appreciate it, Bill. And for anybody else out there, please send your listener mail to us at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Love to discuss it on the air. We'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Bayham III. And we here at the Media Freedom Foundation produce content that illuminates the work of fact-based journalists around the world and offers alternative narratives to the corporate press. Amy Casey is here to tell us more.
Thank you, Nolan. This is Amy Casey of the Media Freedom Foundation with just some of the stories we are working on. From Diablo Valley College, Project Censored Director Mickey Huff and his student Tom Field have nominated a validated independent news story that is a story ignored by the corporate press but covered by the independent press, titled U.S. Government's Little-Known Counter-Propaganda Propaganda Program. The story reports how the U.S. government can, under the Countering Foreign Propaganda and Disinformation Act, simply declare alternative narratives or perspectives that are damaging to U.S. interests as propaganda in an attempt to silence or discredit the source. That can be found at projectcensored.org. In another validated independent news story, this time from Citrus College, Project Censored Associate Director Andy Lee Roth and his student Johnny Zambrano have published, Facebook buys sensitive data about its users to offer marketers increasingly specific targeted advertising. This article looks at Facebook's history since 2012 of purchasing sensitive data about users' offline lives from data brokers in order to use that information or sell it to advertisers. That can be found at projectcensored.org. At the Global Critical Media Literacies webpage, GCML.org, Dr. Nolan Higdon and his student Eduardo Gonzalez from California State University East Bay have released Youth's Dreams Dying in the Golden State. The article observes that the American dream is unavailable to most millennials as Bay Area rent prices continue to increase, but creative options can still be found with an open mind and a little compromise. Also at GCML.org, Bay Area residents are moving to the Pacific Northwest in droves. From California State University East Bay, Dr. Nolan Higdon and his student Justin Much describe the exodus from the San Francisco Bay Area to Portland and Seattle in response to increased cost of living and traffic, as well as the seemingly endless housing crisis. Also from California State University East Bay, Dr. Nolan Higdon and his student, Maximino Cisneros, have published, Was the Warriors Championship Parade Really What Oakland Needed? The story examines the cost of celebration and postulates who should foot the bill for a city juggling many economic issues such as hiring freezes and budget cuts for the school district. The story can be found at gcml.org. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to projectcensored.org/show. There, you can access free content and show your support for Project Censored. I am Amy Casey, and that is the news that did not make the news.
Thanks a lot, Amy. As you can tell, I've been busy. A lot of students producing a lot of work. A lot of great work, though, so it keeps me going.
We want a smash, crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud.
At a minute before 10, that brings to a close Project Censored Radio for today. Coming right up, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and then at 11, we've got The Food Show, today talking with anti-hunger activist and author Andy Fisher about his book, Big Hunger. It looks at the hunger industrial complex. And that's all coming up in the future on KBOO. For now, we're going to go to a message and then to Air Cascadia. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO today. If you want to become a member and support this great station, you can become one when you go to kboo.fm and click where it says donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Report from Kabul speech by Zahair Wahab on Wednesday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House in Portland. Zahair Wahab, a native of Afghanistan and director of graduate studies at the American University of Afghanistan, will present a critical analysis of the Afghani political, military, economic, and cultural situation. Again, that's a report from Kabul by Zahair Wahab on Wednesday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, 4312 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.